Talk about the last pirate of New York, and I want to read a section here from the book written by Rich Cohn. And it's about that area that many people know about. Rich has already referred to it a couple of times, called the Five Points. And if you ever saw the movie Gangs of New York, that's hyper violent, by the way, movie from Scorsese, you'll know, you can almost picture some of what Rich is already talking about, the way that area looked and smelled, and the sweat and the grime that seemed to be everywhere. But here's what the book says. The Five Points bred many of the town's first street gangs, ethnic armies that went to war with each other and with the world. These were less like modern mob outfits, less like the famous five families, than and more like medieval peasant bands. Why? We'll find out why. This was the fertile ground from which our modern gangster nation grew. But why were where's that disconnect? And how is it then that this guy Albert Hicks is really the linchpin between those two epochs? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So, Rich Cohn, why weren't the gangs of New York, as we understand them from either from the book or from the Scorsese movie, why weren't they the model for what we think of as a gangster nation?
Well, they were these basically big armies of kids living on the streets who served the function of political muscle for politicians who were sort of the link between the upper world and the lower world. And most of those people would age out of those gangs and go into regular professions. It was almost like youth clubs. And the thing that changed, really, and this is what Tough Jews was really about, was Arnold Rothstein, who was, not a gangster, who was a gambler, a kind of a fairly wealthy person who grew up in on the up, not far from where the Roosevelts lived in Manhattan, started hanging out down in the slums because he liked to gamble. And he became friends with these young gangsters, and he saw what was going on. And the guys specifically he was friends with were guys who he met were guys like Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, Joe Adonis. And he sort of had a modern mind, and he said, you should reorganize this more along an American business model when everything else in this country is being reinvented, and make it more like an American company. And this idea of these gangsters working for these politicians and ultimately fighting these wars with each other is crazy. You could get together, work together, and instead of working for the politicians could be working for you. And that was ultimately the plan put together by Arnold Rothstein. And there was the whole war with the old gangsters and the new gangsters about setting up this new system. And Rothstein didn't live to see it. He himself was killed in the Park Central Hotel. But they set this up, and the big thing that changed was prohibition, then gave them an actual adult, legitimate, big money business to go into at a time when they might have gone into other lives. They became professional, forever gangsters. And they set up the system of the five families, which is almost just like five unions, as a way to prevent the violence between each other. So if one gangster had a problem with another gangster, instead of going off and having these huge wars, these street wars, they would go to kind of an underworld court, which would hear their case and decide what should be done, who was right, who was wrong. And if a gangster, as a result of that, had to be killed, they didn't just go off and do it themselves. They had a police force, basically, an enforcement wing. And that was Murder Incorporated. And half of that gang were the guys that I wrote about in Tough Jews. Half of them were Jews, half of them were Italians. And most of those guys ultimately died in the electric chair during the Second World War. But when you'd go back and talk to the people that knew those guys who were still around, they would tell stories about these old gangsters. And these old gangsters, if you heard what they had to say, were telling stories about guys like Albert Hicks. And to me, that's the whole connection.
No, I totally see that. Interesting, you mentioned Arnold Rothstein again, of course, the guy who fixed the 1919 World Series, the Chicago Black Sox scandal. I'm sure you've heard that Major League Baseball is building a new Park for a future White Sox-Yankees game in Dyersville, Iowa, right there by the Field of Dreams. I think there's something really beautiful about actually bringing the White Sox back to, I mean, it's so meta, isn't it? The movie about bringing the White Sox players to redeem themselves from the, you know, from the Black Sox scandal is actually going to bring the real White Sox to Dyersville.
That's the whole, that's what's fascinating. That's kind of the thing I'm interested in, which is like, you get these real life gangsters who are in fact imitating movie gangsters,
right?
Who are imitating real life gangsters. And it's this cross pollination, you know, of baseball, you know, its own history becoming the worst thing that ever happened to baseball is like the 1919 World Series, although maybe there were other World Series six before that, it turns out. And that is a connection between the gangsters and the athletes, who are often similar kinds of people, you know?
Right.
And yeah, and that biggest sin of baseball also becomes one of the most fascinating things about baseball, you know? The fact that it has this sort of stain on it makes it
right.
much more interesting.
Yeah. You know, there's something about, I'd love to actually get your point of view on this. I always thought there was, you know, everybody gave up part of their soul, no matter what their religious tradition was, whether they were Italian Catholic or whether they were, you know, Russian or German Jews that had come to the United States, that everybody gave up part of their soul to become part of Murder, Inc., or to become part of the mafia. But there was another side to that too, which was for those tenement buildings and for those neighborhoods, there really wasn't a very high police presence. And in some ways, at least mafia organization brought some organization and some sense of justice and somebody looking out for the little guy, much like we see, you know, as portrayed in the movie The Godfather.
Absolutely. They were neighborhood organizations that took care of people and they filled a vacuum. Otherwise, it would be total chaos. And you've even actually seen that in cities, you know, where the police have gone after the gangs in a big way, and the leaders of the gangs go to prison, and the gangs fall into these neighborhoods fall into complete chaos because the one thing of order that is there is removed. And the what's interesting to me about in Tough Jews was the neighborhood history, you know, like a lot of the Jewish gangsters and a lot of the Italian gangsters, they had these nicknames that had been taken from earlier gangsters of different ethnic groups. So like a famous one is Dutch Schultz, whose real name was Arthur Flegenheimer,
right?
Jewish gangster in Harlem. And Harlem had been a Jewish neighborhood and had been a German neighborhood before that. And Dutch Schultz was just, this guy reminded people of this other guy, this German gangster from an earlier generation. It was like the type kept recurring, just with a different host, kind of, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the things that I found really fascinating about him, you're talking about them giving up their souls, is the extent to which they were actually able to compartmentalize that, you know? And one thing was their job, and it was just part of their job, and it was separate from their family life or even their spiritual life. And the great example of that, it's almost like a joke, is there was a Jewish gangster who was a hitman named Red Levine. And the story about Red Levine was he didn't kill on the Sabbath. And when asked why, he said it wasn't because killing was a sin, it was because you shouldn't work on the Sabbath.
Oh, so funny, isn't
it? That was sort of how they compartmentalized their lives. It was, you know, insane.
I never forgot about how Meyer Lansky broke with Jewish tradition, almost superstition, and named his son after a living member of his family.
Yeah.
I think of that from time to time because I mean, some people thought then that meant his son would be doomed, would be cursed, because that wasn't something that Jews did. That's something that Catholics did. So it was much more common for a guy to name a child after either himself or name it after his living father or whatever. That was something that he picked up from, it would seem, from his association with the Italian Catholics with whom that end of the Jewish end of Murder, Inc. was running. And I always I always wondered about that. Like how that, again, one of those little things where in the melting pot of the United States, these little things that are given up in assimilation, but otherwise they fraternized at a level which many people might consider to be very progressive for its day. They weren't anti-Semitic. They weren't, they were very much, you know, protected each other.
Right. And they saw that, I mean, these are people, the Jews and Italians had this bond mostly because they happened to be in the same slums at the same time going through the same thing. And they formed, you know, they saw each other, that there were so many similarities between their communities that it was just very easy and very natural relationship. And, this is just like a kind of assimilation. And what's interesting about, one of the things that's interesting about gangsters, and it's why The Godfather is a great movie, is just that it's not about gangsters. It's just a way to look at the way all of society operates, just in an exaggerated form. You know, so I don't think it's probably an accident that The Godfather was such a huge movie when probably like Watergate was happening.
Right.
It seemed like the country was operating on the same model of a group of guys sitting in an office just making these decisions, you know. And that's how the underworld worked, and that's how the upper world worked. And I think that all this stuff is about how people become Americans, how they assimilate, how they shed their traditions, and what you have to leave behind.
Yes.
To sort of become an American. And all
yes.
these guys had the situation where their parents spoke a different language in the house than they spoke in the street. And the result was that there was this period where it was like Russia at home and America out in the street. And in this intense pressure cooker of a time, you know, the right way to do things was to sort of wait, work, and hope your kids had a better life. But the gangsters were just, some of them were the most clever people in the communities who just
right.
weren't willing to wait.
They weren't patient.
And yeah, and they didn't even, often their kids didn't even know. They hit it so well, you know, that their kids didn't even know what they did. So, and they moved and they lived these kind of fantasy lives of being these businessmen. So that's really what interested me about it. It's just like
yeah.
normal family stuff just times a billion.
Well, and again, that interplay between the Italian Catholic and the East European Jewish immigrants, that there's that scene in, I guess it's Godfather 2, where Bruno Kirby and Robert De Niro go to an Italian theater production, all being done in Italian for
yeah.
the Italian-speaking audiences, right? At a time when Yiddish theater was still hugely popular in New York. I guess it's had sort of a revival lately for a language that many people speak anymore. But that was that, you know, the Yiddish opera and Yiddish theater. And so everybody, again, this was just part of that strata where there was the pull of the old, but they were assimilating into the new, but not necessarily very quickly. And then some people just decided that they weren't going to be the ones that were going to plant the tree for their kids to get the fruit from. They wanted the fruit from other people's trees. And that's how they started.
Yeah, exactly. And they were going to take this shortcut. And a lot of times, you know, and they didn't, that's why the Jewish mob and most of these mobs disappeared, is because they just didn't, they kind of pulled the ladder up behind them, you
right.
know, as far as they didn't want their kids to do this. And I always said, you know, if you want to know what happened to the Jewish mob, look at what happened to Meyer Lansky's son, one of his sons, is he went to West Point.
I think that was the one that he named after his dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was like the fantasy, wasn't that they wound up being an even bigger mob boss, that it was just this kind of one generation only shortcut to the American dream. But in the end, they were still interested in the same dream as everybody else, which was being American, having a family, having economic security. And the weird thing about Lansky is he was in businesses that became legal. A lot of them were. I mean, he was in gambling, which is basically legal now. And he was in liquor, you know. And Dutch Schultz ran the numbers, which is the lottery. So you can kind of see him as ahead of their time in a way. And the way they saw it is they were filling a need that wasn't being filled by the market. You know, people wanted it. They didn't see anything wrong with it, especially, and they gave to them what they couldn't get in the marketplace.
Yeah. You know, it's like the story of O'Hare Airport, named after the son of Al Capone's mob lawyer, right? That
Yeah.
that he got his son into one of the academies, but part of that was in making a deal with the feds in order to allow that to happen. And then later on, I think he ends up getting whacked. And but the son goes on to become the I think the first either the first ace of World War II, and that's why he ends up we have O'Hare Airport. And but the his mom, the widow of the mob lawyer who got whacked, ends up marrying Frank Nitti, I think, or living with Frank Nitti after or some. But it's again that interconnection between the trying to become respectable part and trying to make as fast a buck as big as possible.
Yeah, well, one of the first gangsters, when going back trying to figure out who the first gangster was, right after Albert Hicks was Monk Eastman, who was a big gang leader, and very violent, and he enlisted in World War I. And actually, there's a funny story, which is when they were giving him the physical induction, they had him take his shirt off, and he had like scars all over, knife wounds. And they said, "What war have you been in?" And he goes, "Just a lot of little wars around New York." And he won like the whatever medal. He won a French medal, big medal in
The Croix de
World War
Guerre.
I in the trenches. Yeah. And when he got home, he was re his full citizenship was restored, and all the crimes were written off the books because he'd been such a big war hero. And he just went right back into the gangs and was found. He died. Was found dead one morning on 14th Street, which is now a very different kind of street than it was then. So there is this weird crossover. And one of the guys I wrote about in Tough Jews, Charlie the Bug Workman, I have his letter where he wrote to the Franklin Roosevelt, volunteering to go on a suicide mission over Japan during World War II, rather than sit in prison the rest of his life.
And that of course begets a lot of the legends of those suicide squads that they were, or in the Dirty Dozen, you know.
Yeah, he was just like that. But they did not take him up on his offer.
So we were talking about The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of a Gangster Nation. Rich Cohen is our guest. We'll get to more of that before we get to more of your questions. But so back to the where we started at the beginning of this hour about the Five Points and the gangs there. The For anybody who saw the movie Gangs of New York, you saw that great, I thought it was a really nice exposition where they showed all the different gangs and the things that they were known for. And that guy, was it Bill the Butcher Poole? Right. And he was a real character, and he was really that bad, right?
Yeah, and he had the I when I because I was I mentioned him briefly in my book, but I was trying to because he has famous last words,
Right.
and because this was a war between the Irish immigrants and the people that consider themselves the real Americans, right?
Right.
So the Anglos, I guess, and they were fighting for territory, and his last words were, "Goodbye, boys, I die a true American."
Right. Well,
Okay,
that was that
so
whole
we don't know
nativist movement.
if he actually said that, but it was reported at the time that he said that. It wasn't made up later.
But that was
And
consistent with what he that he was only one generation away from immigrant or two generations away from immigrant himself. But as soon as he got his, then the all of that influx of all of those Irish became such a threat.
right, well, that's how it always is. My father, his parents were immigrants. My mother, her parents and grandparents were all born American, and they were like considered this terrible thing that my mother married this son of immigrants, even though they were all Jewish, just from different, but it was
Right.
just like complete, it was like one were Americans, one weren't. One's parents spoke English and the other spoke Russian,
Right.
so it's always this sense of being taken over by what comes next. And a generation later, whatever, then it's different, then it's a different ethnic group. And it
Right.
just keeps cycling, cycling, cycling. And that the 5 points was wild because if you were to create a neighborhood to create gangs, like intentionally, you couldn't do a better job.
Right. All right. We've got so many interesting conversations going in this, but let's get back to Albert Hicks himself. we were told the story before we had this digression there a little bit for the background about how he had committed, this was his usual thing, robbing a ship, getting the money, killing everybody on board, or creating a mutiny, and then getting the ship scuttled, getting away. And this was his last big score. So why didn't he get away with it? We'll tell you a little bit more about that coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. And of course, Al Capone would never have gone to war with the law because he owned them. It was just much easier to buy them than to fight them. That was what the real story was of Chicago, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the last pirate of New York, the very pivotal figure, Albert Hicks. And it's on his turn that we see really the creation of the very first gangster. He was the kind of the first hitman, and he worked his enterprise much more in the way that we would understand a John Gotti today. And we'll talk more about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Last pirate of New York, Rich Cohen. You can find out more about him by going to coasttocoastam.com. Also, if you're there, you should sign up for Coast Insider. If you missed the first hour, we had on David Zucker of Airplane and also the Naked Gun series. And it was fun. It was great to talk to him. Very interesting to hear the stories of that movie. And then they have a special event coming up you can find out more about, too. Just go find out more at coasttocoastam.com. So, Rich, we know that as we left the story a little while ago, before our little interpolation there about the 5 points, is that this guy, Albert Hicks, he was a drunken sailor, and he, like a lot of people who we might even associate with some of the actions of a maybe a not forward-thinking or clear-thinking mobster of today, went on a spending spree with this money that he had robbed from the ship, from the people that he had killed. And it was weird stuff too. Like as you mentioned earlier, he was kind of giving himself away all the time by trying to, like, at one point at a bar, didn't he try to use like this, it would have been like the equivalent of like $100 bill.
Yeah. Or like $1,000 bill.
$1,000 bill. And the bartender's like, can't cash that here.
Right.
But he was drawing attention to himself constantly. But why didn't he just ditch everything and go back to what the original plan was for him to make this his last job and to just go back to being a father and a husband?
I think that that's just who he was. I mean, he just was he would get drunk. He was drunk a lot of the time, and when he had money, and he would become this kind of guy out of a storybook who would go around and buy drinks for people and show off. And the term that I like that they used, the verb that the papers used at the time, was he was swanning up and down Hudson.
Oh, yeah.
New York.
My mom used to use that expression. My mom used to say that, right? Yeah.
And he believed, see, back then, because there was no physical evidence, and if there was no bodies, you couldn't charge murder. And he'd done this many times before. He believed that as soon as there were no witnesses and you weren't seen in the act, as soon as you got away from the scene of the crime, you would never be caught. And he believed right up until his sentence was read in court that he would get away. And important to understanding him is knowing that his oldest brother, the oldest of 11, was named Simon Hicks, had also been sentenced to hang in Rhode Island for killing somebody, stealing their money, and taking it to Providence and going on a kind of a bender. And Simon Hicks had escaped from prison and gone out west and was never seen again. And I think he believed that he would always believe that he would get away. And we were talking before about gangsters giving up a piece of their soul. For him, it was very literal. He believed that when he was in solitary confinement as a kid in prison, that he had made a deal with the devil. And he believed when he was caught that the devil had betrayed him, which is why he ultimately confessed. He was trying to change teams at the end of the game. Hmm. He said to the priest that came to him, "Is it too late for me to switch sides, to go with Jesus and to find a place in heaven?" And the priest said, "It's never too late as long as you're alive, but you have to confess your crimes and all of your crimes." And that's why we have his confession. But there's a really chilling thing. And in all the interviews that they would come and do with him, he'd always talk about five people on the ship. And they'd correct him and say, no, there were four people on the ship. And he would say, no, the fifth person was the devil. And so he believed that he was protected, that he would not be caught because he was under the protection of the devil and doing the devil's work on earth.
You mentioned earlier, too, the detective who I think, I mean, without putting too fine a point on it, is kind of a pivotal figure in history at a time when you weren't paid a lot to be a detective, and you were detectives were known for being fairly corrupt and available for a bribe, help, you know, steer a story in another direction. But this one detective who had integrity and believed in the future of detection and crime science and all of that, he was the one who gets assigned to the case when it's no longer considered piracy or being investigated as piracy, but being investigated on land.
Right. And basically, I mean, you're right. The we think of the detectives as you being promoted to detective and it being this important job. Then the detectives worked piecemeal. They got paid per case. And it was like freelance work, and it wasn't enough to really support them and their families. So they would hire themselves out. You can go look at the old newspapers and see the ads. So what happened is if a guy was being investigated by a detective, he would hire the detective. And the detective could do something like lose a murder weapon, you know?
Right.
So basically, this guy, whose name was Detective Nevins, was fixated on this idea that this, which was almost like an amateur kind of thing, detection could be made into a professional thing based on evidence, you know, empiricism and clues and everything else. It was sort of the birth of modern detection, and he took this case. It was just Hicks's bad luck as a criminal to sort of prove that you could make a case for murder, although ultimately they couldn't even charge him with murder because they couldn't find bodies, but you could sort of make the case just with circumstantial evidence without the bodies, just based on the evidence. And they trailed him. And the other thing that happened is at the time, New York had something like 30, 40 newspapers that would print afternoon, morning, and evening editions. And one of them was the New York Times, which had different ownership then and was brand new paper. And if you wanted to make your name as a paper, you did it with crime stories. And the New York Times is no different. And there was a reporter named Elias Smith, and he just embedded himself with the detectives. And he also, working together, helped solve this crime. And as far as for me, for research, wow, what a resource that you could read reports of the manhunt daily filed by Elias Smith. And it was Elias Smith who actually went in to the prison cell, because when they first arrested Hicks, found him in Providence, Rhode Island, and arrested him, they told him he'd been arrested for counterfeit because they were afraid if they said what he'd really been arrested for, he would fight them. And when they got him in the prison cell, he was laughing that they arrested him for counterfeit. They sent Hicks in, they sent Elias Smith in to tell him that he was wanted for triple murder and just to see how he reacted, if they could tell by his response. But he was completely cold, and he insisted that he was completely innocent right up until his sentence was read.
I was very interested in your description of Elias's work, because you were talking about how he referenced himself in the stories, and that he gave great detail and was focused on, you know, capturing the dialogue and telling the story in a narrative form, which really brought it to life. And
yeah.
I'm reminded, and this is I did my dissertation on true crime narratives, and when does really solid news reporting become true crime? And prior to the creation of journalism as we know it in the 1920s, roughly, with the Columbia University and with the focus on treating journalism as a social science, prior to that, there was very little difference in the way in which we would look at true crime narratives today and reporting back then. And I'm really curious to go back and read those stories by him, because I bet you they would read almost like the true crime magazine stories would.
Absolutely.
40,
yeah.
50 years later.
And, you know, it's heavy on dialogue and himself,
right,
as a character. And he went with the detectives because he was from the area that Hicks took off to, so he would know it. And it reads, it's very novelistic what
right,
he wrote. And then
I'm
what's interesting is right after that, he joins the military. And even though he's in the military and he's at the siege of Vicksburg. He's still writing stories for the New York Times about the war, you know, the Civil War.
Right.
So basically, whatever gifts he brought to crime reporting, he then brought to war reporting too.
Well, that very much like Stephen Crane, right? Red Badge of Courage, and how his reporting style was much more, even though it was fact-based, still comes off as it sort of feels like a fictional narrative because they use many of the same motifs and
well,
devices.
And also they didn't have the idea of verbatim exactly. They didn't have tape recorders, and
right.
And they were translate. They had this idea, which is, I could tell you a story, and it could be a funny story, and you could transcribe it, and it won't be funny anymore.
No. Right.
Something's missing. My tone of voice, what I'm doing with my eyes or my hands. And
right.
Then as a writer, you have to take that, and it's not just report what was said, but translate it into language, which means changing it. And that was an accepted thing then. And now, because everything can be taped and shown, that doesn't go on anymore, but it was like an art. Part of the art was translating it into a different language, like translating a poem into a different language.
All right. If that's the Italian expression, il trattore, I can't remember exactly, but it just means the translator is always a traitor.
You have to change it to keep it the same, is basically
right.
The idea. Yeah.
Yeah. But you're sacrificing something. You can't possibly, as a translator, you can't possibly treat the text exactly right, or it wouldn't translate.
It would just be
to make your point. Yeah.
On the page.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's one of the issues with his confession, which is they had a reporter, like a stenographer, go and write down, because he was illiterate, write up his confession. But then when it came time to publish it, they gave it to, you know, a newspaper guy who wrote it up in the language of the time, which is what they would do. But so you get this language that clearly isn't his.
Becomes more formalistic.
And it's more, they're selling it.
Right.
They're selling it in a big way. And it's like they run it through his typewriter. It's like a ghostwriter. So, but that was just an accepted, if you go back and look at the other similar sort of things at the time, that was just a practice of the time, and readers knew it, you know.
Right.
So it wasn't like that was just made it more enjoyable to read, which is it had been translated into newspaper talk, basically.
You know, from the very beginning, journalism is, well, originally reportage or newspaper writing has always been an imperfect science. Journalism continues to be an imperfect science. It can't ever, because we're not, human beings aren't. But it is interesting to see the vagaries that change over time between the things that the journalists always used to, what we would think of as getting wrong today, at the time they thought of was right, and then kind of vice versa.
Yeah, absolutely.
Today, because
what you think matters and how you get at the truth, and they just had a different. The idea of objectivity did never really enter their mind because it would be impossible. I mean,
so,
in this case, the reporter was literally part of the case. He was helping chase him. And
right.
If he hadn't been doing that, then he could have never gotten the story.
Yeah. Yeah, that is very reminiscent of the true crime writers that had embedded themselves. Even Ann Rule, who one of the most famous true crime magazine writers, who goes on to write the Ted Bundy book, The Stranger Beside Me, and I reference her all the time on Coast to Coast because I had a chance to interview her before she died. But, she couldn't help but be part of that story. And so often that is a great difference between, traditional journalism, where the reporter shouldn't be. And if they are, somehow they should hand it off to somebody else instead of trying to write it themselves. But that was back then. That was like, wow, that's totally cool. You're in the middle of the story. It was a benefit.
And also, my feeling about it is, as long as you don't deceive the reader, and the reader knows what it is, it's you get so much more than you lose, really. You know, you get this on the ground reporting, and you get stuff like, one of my favorite moments, maybe favorite's the wrong word, but when they go to arrest Hicks and he's hiding under blankets and he's pouring sweat and he's hiding in a rooming house on the edge of town. And they tell him he's wanted for counterfeiting, and he starts to laugh. And he says, "Why are you laughing?" And he goes, "I'm not a counterfeiter." And he goes, "Do these look like the hands of a counterfeiter?" And he holds out his hands, which look like the hands of a killer. really?
Right. Yeah.
And the detective goes, no, they do not look like the hands of a counterfeiter. You know,
Right.
and you would never have that if the reporter hadn't been there.
Nope. Oh, it's true. So as we talk about the birth of a gangster nation, and we started this conversation by speaking of your original inspiration, which was try to find who was the proto gangster that was the one that later gangsters would talk about. The first one is, that you could find, that if you go back to and you say, well, if you think what we did was cool, of course, you know, the so-and-so, you know, and they always with clever nicknames and with origin stories. And that, so how is it though, that you think that, that he becomes the spark, if you will, for the birth of the gangster nation?
Because he became a pop star. I mean, and he was really good looking and a really famously good dresser, and he was very charismatic. So he became this famous, scary, bad. I mean, the original working title for this book was The Baddest Man. He became this very famous, scary downtown figure who became a almost, even though he was, you know, guilty of these horrible crimes, he became an anti-hero or a cult hero to the people in the slums. And to the point where when the story got told later, like in a game of telephone, it got changed around to the point where now Albert Hicks didn't go out and find this ship and kill these people. In the way it was told and the way it shows up in Gangs in New York and other books that mention it later, they've completely turned the story inside out for some reason, where now they say that Albert Hicks was shanghaied, was kidnapped, was knocked unconscious and drugged and woke up on a ship and was told he had to work or swim, and in a rage and a desire to get his own freedom, kills everybody on the ship. And it's almost like they have to change the story to make him what they wanted him to be, to make it okay to kind of look at him as kind of a hero,
right,
and this neighborhood figure of lore, this kind of Paul Bunyan of the underworld, which he became. And he became that because he became a celebrity, and also when he was hung, and he was hung on Bedloe's Island, which became Liberty Island, the last public execution in New York. 20,000 people came out to watch him hang. And he carried himself with such kind of comportment, I guess, or composure. And was so kind of cool in the way he approached his own death that in almost the way of kind of an existential hero, he became a kind of hero for people in that way. And his last words, I found, because right before I wrote this book, I went back and read for the first time, and I can't believe I never read it because it was so great. I read Executioner's Song. And it's almost the same last words, Gary David Gilmour and Albert Hicks, which is Hicks gets on his knees with all these people screaming and drunk. And, you know, the federal marshal of New York was selling tickets to the hanging for $1. You can get a ship ride out, all the beer you could drink, all the oysters you could eat, and watch the hanging. And they were all drunk, and he gets up and he says, make haste, hang me quick. And I think Gary David Gilmour in the book says, let's do it. And it's basically the same thing, and it's the same thing that made him this kind of cult figure, the same as Gary David Gilmour.
Executioner's Song, Norman Mailer, right?
Yep, yeah.
And you know, it goes back to, again, that narrative style of writing about crime and being involved in the narration yourself. That becomes all the journalistic rage after, you know, after Truman Capote in Cold Blood. But again, it goes back to what you're talking about, that writer, if you read then Executioner's Song right after you read from Elias Smith, was that his name?
Yeah.
That they would feel very familiar, even though they were 100 years apart.
Absolutely. And it's this idea that the things are so intense and evocative that you know, Norman Mailer often kind of overwrote in a way. I mean,
yeah.
I like him, but it could be hard to take, but not in that book.
No.
Because he knew that the material he had was so powerful that he just had to make it very, very clear.
So The Last Pirate of New York, we've got, as you can hear in our conversation with Rich Cohen, he knows so much about gangs, mob, how things work in the underworld. And he, it's not just this story, but his other books as well. And so I'll just say, we'll kind of blow it open. You can be about this story or it can be something else. We'll give you all the numbers you need to join the conversation with Rich Cohen next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.